You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Commence station log Deep Space Nine, Commander Benjamin Sisko, Stardate 46388.2. At the request of the Bajoran Provisional Government, Starfleet has agreed to establish a Federation presence in this system following the withdrawal of the Cardassian occupational forces. The first contingent of officers, including my Chief of Operations, Miles O'Brien, arrived 2 days ago on the Enterprise. Greetings, Starfleet officers, members of the Bajoran militia, and any pleasant listening Cardassians. Welcome back to the Hit or Miss Star Trek podcast for a bit of a different one this week. As you can probably tell from the promotion and all of the various descriptions and things on screen, this is a rewind episode, our very first one. I am currently off trying to do some work on the Silver Screen podcast, keeping things there ticking over, and so I needed a week's break basically from fully doing Star Trek podcasts, although there are at least a couple in the chamber ready to go, don't worry. But it occurred to me that since we're doing a series on the Bajorans and the Cardassians, it would be nice to go back and revisit an episode that we already did. It was actually our fifth episode that we recorded. Back then I was flying solo, as I am now, but not, that was before DK came on board and took his leave of absence. But yeah, so I was flying solo, just starting off, and I was joined by Rick Everson from 10 Backwards podcast, who's been on the podcast a few times, to review the episode Emissary, the pilot of Deep Space Nine, which I figured I have to include in this Bajoran and Cardassian series because it's pretty dang important. And if you listened last week, I did mention how I thought Ensign Ro was kind of like a prototype Deep Space Nine pilot in a lot of ways, the things that it set up, etc., even though it was apparently not intended to be. And so I thought we have to deal with the actual pilot, the episode that deals with the Cardassians withdrawing, the Bajorans inviting the Federation, just finding their feet as they become free, etc. So yeah, I thought, why not revisit Emissary? So be kind, this is, as I said, it's a very early episode, so things might not necessarily be as polished as they were, but I really do think, listening back, it was a fantastic episode. Myself and Rick had a great discussion, Rick had some great personal anecdotes and things about the episode, and we discussed it at length and talked about, the themes and the quite deep metaphors that are in Emissary, as you'll hear if you listen on. But yeah, I do highly recommend listening to it. It is a very good listen, and it's surprising how polished we actually were, or the podcast was in those early days. So yeah, I'm just basically here to bridge the gap to give you something to listen to that's new if you have heard this, and to explain the situation. I have also done my limerick and haiku, as I've been doing for every episode in the last couple of seasons, which obviously wouldn't have been present in the episode as recorded. So I figured, why not add them in this little intro, give it a little bit of extra something for the loyal fans. And I will come to those, I promise. But before that, I also thought, I've been asking everyone else this season what their favourite kind of Bajoran and Cardassian things are, whether it be characters, episodes, arcs, etc. And I haven't had a chance to answer myself. Basically, if there are any glaring omissions, it's because we're going to be covering them on the podcast, or we maybe already have. As I picked the episodes, I naturally chose a lot of the ones that are my favourites. So you can kind of look to that, even though it wasn't really my idea as such to do this. It was my arm was kind of twisted by Lady Vianne, but in fairness to her, she's more than earned that by coming on board for the majority of the episodes in this season. And so as I kind of decided I was doing Cardassian and Bajoran stuff, I picked things that were basically almost all my favourites anyway, so you can look to that, as I said. But apart from that, I can't say I really react fantastically to the Cardassians and the Bajorans. They're not my absolute favourites. I don't dislike them by any means, but they're not my favourite races in the Trek universe. But that said, if you ask me to pick favourites, there are things I can mention that might not necessarily be stepping on podcasts in this series. First of all, the thing that springs to mind, the character of Tora Zial, Cardassian and Bajoran, of course. Really liked that character. I liked all the actresses that played her, but especially Melanie Smith, the actress who played her at the end of her tenure on the show. I like in Discovery, President Lyra Rilak, the kind of Cardassian Bajoran human, who I think counts, and I think she's, again, a fantastic character and actually quite nuanced. So I have to shout her out. Obviously, Ensign Ro, we're doing a trilogy on her, and you'll have already heard the first part, so she's obviously something I really did respond to her story and really loved the growth, the way that story actually grows over the episodes and years. So as story-wise, apart from the ones we've already done, I do think there are some great things in Deep Space Nine that I just didn't have a chance to include, but would have loved to. Episodes like Return to Grace springs to mind. Sacrifice of Angels, obviously dealing with, you know, the Cardassian takeover of the station and Federation getting it back, and the big event that happens there that I won't spoil. And just trying to think. I think it's called Tribunal, the episode where we learn about the Cardassian judicial system, is also another favorite of mine. And and since I'm geeky, I'll also point out I really do quite like a lot of the ships from both species. I've got the Eagle Moss models of things like the Galor-class Cardassian ship, the Bajoran Raider, and a Bajoran Freighter even. So yeah, quite like them. And obviously Deep Space Nine itself, I have the model of that, and it's gorgeous, being a Cardassian station run by the Bajorans. So yeah, but I've kept you long enough. I don't think you know, anybody wants to hear me rambling for too long when the episode is waiting to be played. So I will get on with, as promised, the limerick and the haiku, just to close things out here for now and before I cross over to myself. So first of all, I will start with my limerick, as it always tends to be the most popular. So my limerick for Emissary is as follows. Sisko arrives on the station, takes command with some trepidation, frees Nog from the slammer, finds a wormhole to Gamma, and becomes a Bajoran sensation. That one came surprisingly easy to me. You're probably saying, because it's rubbish, but hopefully not. So yeah, and my haiku, weirdly enough, my haiku, I don't normally make rhyme because that's not necessary for a haiku, but for whatever reason, it just kind of came to me, and it rhymes, like, you know, rhyming poetry, even though it doesn't need to. So anyway, my haiku for Emissary is as follows. Bajor is now free to find the Emissary, not linearly. So yeah, three lines, three rhymes, you know, not great, but hopefully enough that it's something worthwhile to have listened to. And if you liked it, thank you so much. I do put a lot of kind of, you know, I mock sometimes, but I put a lot of time and effort into doing them just to, you know, just to give a little bit of extra spice to the episodes. But anyway, we are done here, so without any further ado, really hope you enjoy this episode. Myself, Rick Everson, discussing the Deep Space Nine pilot Emissary. So over to me.
Hello there, faithful viewers, and welcome back to episode 5 of the Hit or Miss Star Trek podcast. I am your usual host, Mike Wilson. And I am joined this week by another special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself, sir?
Hi, I'm Rick Everson, long-time Star Trek fan. Really glad to be on the show.
Awesome, awesome. Yeah, one of the funniest sort of Twitter usernames, Sheer Ricking Hubris. Never fails to make me laugh.
I was quite pleased with myself when I did that. I think I've recently changed it from Sacred Chalice of Ricks.
So, nice. See? Nice. I like it. We are going to be going through the usual categories and things that we do on the podcast. This is the fifth episode. There was one slightly different, but if you haven't been watching, basically the first section is like a getting to know you type thing. I'll have a chat with Rick and we'll explain, or he'll explain what kind of drew him to Star Trek and some of his favorites and things. The second part will be the hit or miss section, where I'll fire out just five random things from anywhere in the Star Trek universe. Just five this week because we've got a long episode to review, because after that we'll get into the main episode review, which, as you'll have seen on the thumbnail, is the Deep Space Nine pilot, Emissary. So we both have, I think, a lot of thoughts and stories and stuff about that one. Yes. Should be interesting. So without any further ado, I will start with section number one, which is the section that I call Hailing Frequencies Open. And this, as I've explained, is kind of a getting to know you type thing. If you've been watching the previous episodes, then you'll know what's in store for you, Rick. So just first of all, the very first sort of question to ease you in is, what was it that first drew you to the world of Star Trek? Was there one particular episode that kind of hooked you in? And can you remember the first one you ever watched?
I absolutely can. I've got very distinct memories. I was in the last year of junior school, and I was aware of Star Trek, but I'd never watched it. I'd never seen it. No one in my family was into sci-fi particularly. But
right,
one day at school, a lad, Kieran was his name. I forget his surname, I distinctly remember him saying to me, "Did you watch Star Trek: The Next Generation last night?" And I was like, "No, I heard they'd done this new Star Trek show, and it's not got Spock or Kirk or anything in it. But not that I'd ever seen Spock or Kirk, really."
Fair enough.
But he seemed quite enamoured of it, so I thought, "I'll give it a go. Sounds like it might be interesting." So the following Wednesday night, 6 o'clock, BBC Two, as all UK Next Gen viewers will remember. I watched it, and the first episode I watched was The Naked Now.
Oof.
So this always gets a laugh because it's not considered a brilliant episode.
Yeah, it's a bit of a baptism of fire, that one, really, isn't it?
It is, but it absolutely hooked me. I absolutely loved it. I had no idea who these people were, but, you know, just over the course of the 45 minutes, I got completely sucked into the world. I loved it. It was, thought the captain sounds like really smart and sensible. I love the action guy, first officer. They have a robot. I didn't even know what a Klingon was. So, just Worf was some alien to me at that point.
Yeah.
But what always sticks in my mind as well is in that episode, because obviously The Naked Now is a kind of a retell of an original series episode, The Naked Time.
Right, yeah.
And I think that got me. I was like, oh, wow. Oh, that's fantastic. That totally draws in. This is just completely new. This is a continuation. And I'm like, a continuation of a series I still hadn't seen, so I'm not sure why I was so impressed. But we're talking shared universe before Marvel ever thought of it.
Absolutely. So,
yeah, the fact that it is not a great episode, I'd recognise the flaws, but that whatever anyone says about The Naked Now, that's gonna have a special place in my heart because
absolutely, yeah.
It set off quite a thing.
Yeah, well, every episode's somebody's favourite, isn't it? Even though we laugh. I mean, it's not that I think it's terrible. It's just one of those really weird ones where it's a weird decision for me to, in your second episode, have everybody acting out of character before you've established what their characters are.
I remember reading Roddenberry's idea, but thinking behind it was, if they all get drunk and open up, we'll get an idea of, what these characters are really like.
Okay.
It turns out a lot of them are just really horny. So.
Isn't that always the way? So, yeah, it's probably fair to say that Next Gen would be your favourite series if you had to pick them.
It's almost a draw. I recognise Deep Space Nine, in my eyes, is absolutely, I think, a superior series because... and it just, this is my opinion, you know, other your own opinions may vary, but I adore Deep Space Nine, the story it wove, the way it stretched the idea of Star Trek and pushed it in very different ways and really played with the idea of what the Federation actually meant and the impact that had on people beyond everything. But the Next Generation is like, that's like absolutely my, that's where I came in. You know, that's always going to have that comfort. It's like, that's my, almost my original family kind of thing. So,
yeah, that's fair. I think it's, I think, I can't remember where I read it, but I think I read somewhere that it was like, you'd love to live on the Enterprise D, but you'd love to watch the adventures from Deep Space Nine. It's a better adventure to watch, but you wouldn't want to live through it kind of thing. But
it's flipping dangerous.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But, right, so if you've been watching, you'll know what's coming then. So, if you had to pick three episodes from throughout the entire Star Trek franchise that represented your favorites or what you would show to someone watching for the first time or just that exemplifies what Star Trek is at its best, what three episodes would you pick?
Okay, so I feel like I'm going to have to cheat initially and kind of sneak two in by saying Best of Both Worlds.
That's fine. Well, a two-parter I would count as one anyway, so that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I've got the Blu-ray where they're edited together, so it's kind of one long one.
Awesome.
Yeah, so, I just find that that's one of the pinnacles of it. Then I think...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Corbomite Maneuver.
Ah, interesting. Cool.
I absolutely adore that episode so much. It's fantastic. It's got so much stuff about, you know, it's a very tense situation, you know, and it is a lot about how a character responds to tension, how they respond to facing the unknown, how they respond to threats. But at the same time, it's not their automatic thing to fight and destroy the enemy. It's that trying to make that understanding. And the point where they apparently disable Baylock's ship and have to turn back to help, I think that is one of those early times where we really exemplify what the Federation was really supposed to be all about, or what Starfleet was supposed to be all about.
Absolutely. I completely agree. That's one of my absolute all-time favorites, and it doesn't come up a lot. But I just love what the episode's named for. I love the Corbomite Bluff as a kind of very Starfleet way to get around. You know, we face destruction, but rather than being sort of going angrily and attacking, it's just trying to outsmart with like a poker-style bluff, you know. And I love that. That exemplifies Kirk, I think, for me, more than any of the sort of hand-to-hand fighting or anything.
So. And then I think for probably my final choice, and this is a really, really difficult one. I know it's a DS9, but I've got about four or five choices narrowing it down. I would say, though, Far Beyond the Stars.
Yeah, that was one of my three. Definitely. It's just too, it's almost too good not to pick, just as a, outside of even Star Trek and genre, it's just amazing. So absolutely. Yeah. You can give me a shout out if you want of your other choices, because last week Kelly just said honourable mentions and then listed about six.
So. Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, the ones my somewhat mixed bag that was going to that were vying for that last spot. Past Tense, because I think that's incredible. Again, I'm just sneaking a two-parter there.
That's fine.
I think that's a brilliant one in terms of the social commentary that Star Trek does, and it's quite a brutal on the nose one that. And terrifying that it's actually not, we're really getting close to that time when we're not any better.
Yeah, we're not that far off, really.
We're no better than what the people depicted in that episode. So
yeah.
It's a scary one, that, but it's a fantastic watch. And the other one is, and this is just because this is my ultimate comfort food episode, is Looking for Parmak in All the Wrong Places.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I really enjoy that.
That's just fun.
It's just the absolutely ridiculous premise of Quark trying to woo a Klingon lady and Worf having to help him. The crazy stuff behind that is brilliant.
So. Awesome. Oh, that's fair enough. I'm surprised you didn't. I was waiting for you to name Trials and Tribulations from DS9.
It is an excellent episode as well. So, yeah. But now I think looking for Palmer always comes back in the one that's going to make me laugh. So.
Fair enough. I felt like there was a criminal lack of DS9. If I didn't pick Far Beyond the Stars, which I did because you have to, my DS9 choice would have been Homefront and Paradise Lost, which I don't think gets enough love.
It does not get enough love, and I could rave on about that two-parter for a long time because it's awesome. Criminally underrated. What they're trying to do and say with that is amazing.
Well, I'll move us to the next section now then, and the next section is the hit or miss section, what the podcast is kind of named and famous for. So as I said, you've got no idea what's coming. They're just five random things I wrote down a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
I'll shout it out, and if you tell me if you think it's a hit or a miss and then why, I'll give my thoughts. We can debate if necessary back and forth. And then, after five of those, we'll move on. But the very first thing on the hit or miss for this week is a movie, and it's the movie Star Trek Into Darkness. Hit or miss?
Right. I'm going to go controversial and say hit.
Okay.
And I know it's not popular, but I've had long conversations with people about this, and I feel that Star Trek 09 is absolutely fantastic, but I kind of, my view of it is it's half the story and the other half is Into Darkness. Star Trek 09 tells a brilliant adventure story of how Kirk gets the center seat. And I think Into Darkness is how he matures into the center seat.
Right. I can see that.
I appreciate some of the flaws, and, you know, I do agree that maybe trying to rehash Wrath of Khan in some of the ways was not as successful as it could have been. But looking as a whole, like, I kind of see Kirk's journey and Spock's journey through those two as a better overall whole across the two movies. So that's kind of why I always class it as a hit, because I think viewed together from that, they work. Whereas Into Darkness on its own, yeah, I appreciate it. I don't. It's not as good.
Yeah, that's fair enough. But I would probably say it's a miss for me, but just like a very soft miss, but mainly for the reasons that you've already alluded to, which is that I didn't like that it was just a rehash of Wrath of Khan. I think it would have been kind of cooler if they'd just done an original story to have those kind of stakes and stuff. And I really hate the ending just being basically, we'll revive him with magic blood, because they couldn't do the whole Katra thing. And I was like, oh, really?
I mean, you can have the actor self-sacrifice without him necessarily dying of it.
Yes, I think there was
magic blood. But...
Yeah, there was a better way to write that. But I think there's a few shortcuts in that bug me, because I didn't like the whole beaming from Earth to the Klingon homeworld and stuff as well that happens in that. And I'm like...
I'm glad they forgot about that for Beyond.
Yeah, because at that point, it's like, why do you bother with starships? Do you know what I mean?
My biggest complaint about Into Darkness, and I know I've classed as a hit, so to now turn around and say my biggest complaint is a bit weird.
Fair enough.
I just don't think they made good use of McCoy in it.
Yeah, no, he's criminally underused in all three of them. Because Carl Urban's really, he's so good, and he's channeling, I think, the original character better than anybody else out there.
He does a great job, but he's just rattling off weird metaphors and having very little practical purpose.
Yeah, it is. It's a shame. But yeah, the other criticism that I had was that I've never really been a fan of Section 31 as an idea. So when they brought up that was kind of the other half of the plot was, we're rehashing Wrath of Khan, but we're throwing Section 31 in there. It was like, oof. It's a lot of things I don't like all in one package. You know?
I'm very much the other way. I love the idea. I hate Section 31 as an organisation, but I love the concept that they're in there. Because it's one of those things that DS9, I think, did really well, is to say the Federation is a great idea in principle, but in practice, it's never going to quite go that smoothly. And I think the biggest way of saying that is that we have this furtive organisation of Section 31. But overall, what this says is, and to me, this is what makes Star Trek one of the really engaging watches, is that it's one thing to achieve a utopia, but to maintain it is the difficult thing. Mm. And this is what I really enjoy is you know, Picard going out there and presenting the best face of the Federation is he's pushing that forward, but there's other people in the background sort of trying to keep it going, keep it there. And they're fighting things like Section 31, who were saying who were trying to maintain utopia in the worst way.
Yeah. But having said that, just to bring it around the other side, because as you said, you said hit and give some criticisms. Hmm. I said sort of slight miss. But having said that, I am a big hypocrite because I have got a model of the USS Vengeance because it looks badass. It's staring at me from the top of one of my DVD shelf things because it's everything I should hate because it's basically just how many guns can we stick onto this stealth shell of a ship, but it looks so damn cool. So.
It is, yeah. I mean, it's just like there's some awesome sequences through it. So it's if nothing else, there's a lot of fun in the movie, but I just do like that it ties the thematic thing of Kirk gets the seats and then Kirk kind of matures to the seats a bit.
Yeah, I totally. I fully understand, and it's not by any means, I would think, my worst movie. It's not even in probably my bottom three, but very watchable, but a bit of a miss for me. So we'll move on to number two, which is something from a movie, and the second thing for this week is the character B4 from Star Trek Nemesis. Hit or miss?
You know, before doing this, I was thinking I'm so normally quite upbeat and positive about almost everything in Star Trek. I'm fairly sure I'm going to give you all hits, but then you roll that B4, and I'm like, actually,
that's why I do it. I try to make it as varied as possible. Yeah,
miss. I'm afraid B4 is just it was just like a lot of Nemesis. And I fervently believe that within Nemesis, there's a great movie that a different director could have teased out. Mm-hmm. And I think one of those points is B4 that they could have done much better. But as it is, we just feel like we're rehashing Data's brother from Law, but in no effective way because he's not Law. He's not got a nefarious plan. He's just like a. It's just a walking tool of Shinzon's.
Yeah.
Coupled with the fact that Shinzon's motives and plans are sort of up and down and all over the place and increasingly unclear as the movie goes on.
Oh, yes, yeah. exactly. Yeah.
I think the final nail for B4, I think, was probably in Picard when he's just relegated to a
gone.
Drawer.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just in someone's big drawer because essentially they just said, oh, yeah, the Data's Matrix was downloaded in turn, but, you know, B4 was just couldn't handle it, so it's no
didn't
use.
Work. Absolutely.
So yeah. B4's only saving grace that he was this potential for Data's return. Yeah. We see what happens there, and it's just like, yeah, no, that didn't work. Oh, okay then.
Yeah, that did reek of like why was this done by different writers or whatever, and we don't like it because I thought myself that B4 basically was a plot device to give you like. We want to kill off Data, but we don't want to kill him off permanently. So it's that little hope that happens at the end of the movie. And even the, I think it's the Countdown comics and stuff, have him like fully restored as Data and like the captain of the Enterprise and everything. And I was like, oh, so maybe that's what they were going for. And it was just a way to do what you said, basically have an act of self-sacrifice, but without killing the character off permanently. Yeah. But then, like you said, it's so almost indulgent and, I think the fact that I know that whole plot line was written by Brent Spiner as well, it just reeks of like, well, this is what happens when you give actors too much creative control because it's not a great plot device at all. It's just, it's silly. And it's, like you said, he's not intelligent or particularly impressive or anything before. It's just like, oh, he has another one of you. It's a blank slate. You can download yourself into it later, but shush. Then, like you said, by Picard, they're like, forget about that. It didn't work. Never mind.
I agree. Clearly the Picard writers felt the same about B4 as I do.
Well, yeah, and myself, as I say, I should have said at the start, miss as well, because it just didn't fit in that movie, which was all about Picard's identity anyway. And then, like you said, it's by the end, what was the purpose?
That's the frustrating thing about it as well. You actually have the chance for two big, you know, similar things. You have Picard and a clone of himself, and you have Data and another version of himself.
Yeah.
And they kind of touch on that. Picard and Data do have this conversation, which to me is maybe one of the better points of the movie. When Data says, you know, there's a difference. You and I aspire to be better, but our evil or our doubles don't. But again, it's just like, but we're kind of like ignoring the fact that we're ignoring law.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, if that character had been law, that would give you so much more richness to do that anyway. Mm-hmm. And it's a character that's pre-established, so you don't have to do any of the legwork. But I mean, the whole point that the film tries to see is like nature versus nurture with Picard and Shinzon. And it's like Shinzon saying to Picard, you'd be the same if you'd been raised in these horrible Riemann minds, being suffering abuse daily and everything, but that doesn't really work for an android.
I give Nemesis a lot more credit than a lot of people do, and I think there is the shell of a good movie in there, but
there's bits that I enjoy.
It's not enough of it.
Yeah. not one of my favorite movies. Definitely. Speaking as we vaguely were about Romulans, the third thing on the list for today is a Deep Space Nine episode, and it's the episode In the Pale Moonlight. Hit or miss?
Oh, hit. Absolutely hit. 100,000,000% hit.
I had a feeling. There you
go. Yeah, I mean, this plays into the thing I was saying earlier, that to try and preserve that utopia is not always as easy, you know, and it's the battle to uphold those high-sounding morals that the Federation has, and this is the closest, you know, when a Starfleet captain is that compromised, as Sisko it feels by the end of this episode. I mean, I love it. It's a great, and Avery Brooks acts the hell out of it as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So it's beautifully done. It's really intense Sisko, and it's Garak. It's essentially an hour of intense Sisko and Garak. So, you know, you can't go wrong with an episode like that.
Yeah, I know a lot of people that are huge fans of it. It's probably my most controversial hot take, because I would say it's a miss, personally, for the reasons that I got into kind of... I touched on earlier with, like, Section 31 and stuff. I don't like to see Starfleet compromised, and I don't like the idea that the captain who's meant to be like...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This beacon is so severely compromised. And whilst I appreciate that Avery Brooks did a great job acting it, and selling that he actually gives a damn despite what he's kind of saying, I feel like I resent the writers for putting the character in that position, if that makes sense. Because I'm like, well, he doesn't get to be this cool sort of beacon of greatness and shiningness that, like, Picard got to be, or even Kirk got to be, you know what I mean? And it's like, why have we got to drag all our heroes down all the time? You know?
That is a good point, and it is a difficult episode in terms of that. I feel that some stuff did spiral out of his control a bit. Don't necessarily blame him entirely. I feel a lot less sympathetic towards Admiral Ross in Series 7 when he essentially disappears so Section 31 can manipulate Bashir on Romulus. I think you willingly just vanished out and let Section 31 do what they want. Whereas Sisko is like, I'm going to do this one move, but then things spiral and spiral. And he regrets it, and Ross doesn't regret it. Well, Ross still defends it. I don't know if he necessarily doesn't regret it, but I think a little off topic, I suppose. But,
no, it's absolutely a good point, though, because I think it's one of those things where I'm way more accepting of bad Starfleet admirals, because it's such a trope that I can just fully accept, admirals are going to be jerks, basically. But for whatever reason, with the captain, I'm like, oh, no, they're not allowed to be flawed. I just can't have this. But, it's probably a bit hypocritical on my part, but it's just a little issue I had.
No, it's completely, because that's very much the point, though. Certainly through original and next gen, they are supposed to be the absolute pinnacle. And when you look at that episode in series 2 of Discovery, where Pike's been carrying this chip on his shoulder about being left out of the war, and finally Cordell turns around and says, "You were kept back because you're the best of us.
Yeah,
the war was making us go to dark places, and we were keeping you our best, you know, our most shining paragons of virtue. You were there to come back and rebuild us good again afterwards."
Yes, absolutely. So I love that.
That kind of totally backs up what you're saying about what you should have expected of a captain. But
I think, I think at least people would hopefully at least understand where I'm coming from. And it's not like I'm saying, like, this is a terrible bit of television. Because like I said, the writing and direction and everything are excellent. But I just think in terms of, well, the writing's excellent, but the plotting not so much, if that makes sense. Because I don't like they were put in that situation, and I would rather have, you know, just done something else to get the Romulans into the war. You know what I mean? Because I realize it was kind of a necessity, but I think there was perhaps a better way about it. Anyway, but having said that, I haven't watched that for a long time, and I may well rewatch that episode and completely change my mind. So
I don't know if you're much into the novels, but there is a DS9 novel called Hollow Men by Una McCormack that follows directly on from that story and has Sisko go back to Earth and deal with a lot of his guilt. And that's a really good accompaniment to the episode.
Oh, okay. I probably would have appreciated it a lot more if that had happened in the series as well. And that's cool.
It is one of those things like, this would have been brilliant if it happened on screen, you know?
Because there is that great moment at the end of the episode where it's him basically trying to convince himself he can live with the guilt. And there's at least an episode's worth of something you could do with that, I have to look that up. Excellent. Fair enough. We're sticking with DS9 for number 4 out of 5 then on the hit or miss section. And this is the character of Brunt, hit or miss.
Oh, hit. Absolutely hit. I love Brunt. it's Jeffrey Combs, so you're not going to find many people who are going to say that Brunt's not amazing. I mean, just on that, he plays Brunt, he plays Wayoon. I mean, the man is incredible.
Yeah.
He's been playing those. They're so wildly different characters and wildly different purposes of those characters. It's brilliant. But yeah, I think Brunt's fantastic. He's that great example of the sort of person who just resents Quark because Quark's gone off on Frankenau and done some stuff outside. And he's just, I don't know if there's some metaphor for some sort of nationalism or something in there. I might be reading too much into it, but Brunt has such a problem with Quark, particularly, and his family, who strayed off course and makes his life mission to sort of destroy them.
I see him kind of as a kind of, maybe it could well just be me, but I see him as like a metaphor for government bureaucracy and the kind of like, we want you to better yourself, but you better still come and pay your taxes and live where we tell you to and all the rest of it. So it's kind of, I think that's the message there, is that Quark's kind of almost the tax exile of Ferengina. And he's like, no, we're not having this.
And it's weird because actually Quark and Brunt openly ascribe to the same views of Ferengi society.
Absolutely.
But they're always at odds because, so it's always this hilarious thing where Quark would happily agree with Brunt and just do as he's told, but his brother and his mother are constantly driving him down the wrong path.
I think there's a little bit too much bureaucracy and officiousness to Brunt for Quark as well, though, because for all that he talks a big game, I think he is a bit of a rebel, and he wouldn't want to be kind of like, I'm doing what the government tells me, like a good little boy. It's kind of like, there's that side of him
this is the Quark who helped Bajoran sort of under the radar during the occupation and things. So there is that. As much as he might try and deny it, there is definitely that side to him. So.
Exactly. I completely agree. I think Brunt is a huge hit because of the way he's played to be that kind of stoic, bureaucratic kind of foil to Quark and the Ferengi. And the way he threads that middle ground between the sort of evil Ferengi with whips of next gen and the kind of comic relief of DS9. He almost is a way to understand how they can be that wildly different, because there's a middle ground there as well, you know. But yeah, I completely agree. Jeffrey Combs is great. Weirdly, coincidentally, he was just on Lower Decks as we're recording this on the last episode as well.
he was brilliant. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, just obviously a voice role, but so good. But yeah, I think he's great in everything. And when I was looking up that episode, I fell down like a wiki hole of looking up Jeffrey Combs roles and episodes and things. And saw courtesy of the wiki that in at least one episode of DS9, he plays both Weeun and Brunt in the same episode. And I was like, that's epic, man.
I can only imagine his schedule that week. Who's doing my makeup? What ears am I getting on?
But yeah, we both are big fans of Jeffrey Combs and Brunt. So finally, for today, speaking of Lower Decks, the final thing on the list is Brad Boimler, hit or miss.
I love Brad Boimler, absolutely.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's I can relate to Brad Boimler anyway.
Yep. Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, massive hit and very, very relatable. I've to pretend I'd be like the Commander Ransom of the Cerritos, but I'd be Boimler all day.
Yeah.
We can't pretend otherwise.
If I was in Starfleet, I would be so enthusiastic, absolutely love every second, but competence-wise, I'd probably only be a boy little fool.
Oh, yeah, and I'd constantly be getting into just ridiculous scripts and things, because I do that now anyway.
So. Yeah. Also, I would have got just as excited, in fact, I did get just as excited as he did at the end of Season 1 when the Titan arrived.
Oh, completely. So, yeah, I would have done exactly the same, and I would have completely been straight applying for that transfer to the Titan and abandoning my friends as well.
I wouldn't even bother to pack. I'd have been straight over there.
Straight across. Yes. Yeah, but great character, well-written, and I think very well acted by Jack Quaid as well. So,
yeah.
Great work. Awesome. Well, that was relatively painless, at least. But there's always at least one, I think. I've tried to make it that way, so there's at least one almost on purpose, but yeah. So we'll leave that in the rear view and we'll move to the next section, which is going to be the bulk of the episode, and that is the main review. So we'll begin analysis, as I say, and I will just start by saying, as spoiler-free a way as possible, what are your sort of general thoughts on Emissary, the two-part pilot of DS9, or the feature-length pilot, I guess, if it's stuck together?
Okay. I've gone through it. Emissary, I'm always mixed. I've gone through stages. When I first watched it, I absolutely loved it. As DS9 progressed, I kind of was quite cool to it. And then after the end, I loved it again. So it's watching it now, I really enjoy it. Absolutely love it. It's got loads of great stuff. Introduces its characters well, sets up the stage. Sets up a whole new type of Star Trek series in a new way.
Oh, completely, yeah, absolutely. My without getting too far into it for spoilers, my view of it completely changed after this watch from what I had sort of remembered it being, because the only other times I'd watched it, I was very young. In 1993, I would have been 11. So then I think that may have been the first time I watched it was then, and then maybe a couple of years later I tried it again. But yeah, so very different experience this time. A lot of very surprising things that I either didn't remember or that didn't hit for whatever reason, one way or the other. But yeah, it's a pilot that does a heck of a lot. And as you say, that sets up surprising number of things, both sort of Star Trek familiar and wildly varying and different. So
I think it's quite good, as it leaves quite a lot of things sort of open. You don't even realise. But then when you go back, you think, okay, they actually played that out later. I don't even remember it being there, but that's actually relevant. These are things they play out.
Yeah, I was reading about that, and I was very surprised to read that they didn't have anything in mind, because it seems like they're going somewhere. But with little moments like, just off the top of my head, Odo saying, I was found in the Denorius Belt and I don't know where I'm from and whatever. They had no idea where they were going with that, but it's there in the pilot. So it's like, we could do something interesting with it. You never know. And I was like, that spawned everything. You know what I mean? But
I remember shortly before it finished, I think I read an interview with the producers who said, we're so happy about the finale. And I think you'll be able to see if you watch the pilot and then the finale, how everything is tied from a beginning to an end. And I was like, oh, I'll show you. They paid a bit of lip service to the pilot or something. Sure, it's not that, but then I watch him and think, okay, yeah, actually you do see where these threads have set up, and then over the course of 7 years, where they all go and how they end.
I think, DS9 is the series that's the most like a novel, in that you can't really just dip in and out of episodes. But if you watch the whole thing, start to finish, it is one fantastic, like, contained story.
Absolutely.
So what it is, I've got, like, random just sort of chronological notes. So bear with me. I'll probably just go through it in order, and then if you want to just chime in with anything that I may have missed or thoughts of your own, and I'll just go through it. And afterwards, I'll ask you if you have any exciting stories or anything about Emissary, I guess.
Yeah. Okay.
You had hinted about that, so we shall see. But I'll try and get through the...
Not sure I used the word exciting. You may have oversold it.
Well, stories. Anything's exciting to me.
Yeah. Just manage the listeners' expectations a little bit. I'm not that interesting.
Fair enough. Oh, well. Well, so we get into the start of the episode, and obviously goes without mentioning, we're straight in the middle of Best of Both Worlds, the whole Battle of Wolf 359, which I don't love as an opening, controversially. Because I recognize that it's done well and it connects the Jennifer Sisko story, but tonally it just doesn't seem to fit with the rest of the DS9 series at all.
For the purpose of the audio, I have walked off in rage.
it's not that I think I get the kind of it fits the theme of war and all the rest of it, but it's weird that it's the only appearance of the Borg in the series, because it would seem to indicate that they're going to do more about that, and it just seemed like.
Yeah, no, I kind of always wondered if we would see the Borg again, because it's almost like there's that little open thing with Sisko. Always to the point of, like, you feel a little bit cheated that he didn't get to pop up in First Contact.
Yeah, because, Worf was on the Defiant, but, that's the thing. I mean,
apparently they had written a bit for him, but then they sort of ended up taking it out. So.
Yeah, it's weird, because I know they do pay lip service to that's what the Defiant was invented for. Which, by the way, poor job, Starfleet, because it got immediately trounced when it did the one thing it was meant to do. Never mind.
That's true. I adore this. The Wolf 3-5, I was so excited when it opened with that. And I thought,
fair
we're
enough.
Actually going to see this battle. Oh, my God, we're going to see this battle.
Yes, I will say that. The actual, like, the special effects, the model shots, and the actual seeing of some of the ships that were involved, rather than just seeing like Rex when the Enterprise D arrives, was fantastic. The scene itself, I think, is brilliant, but it just seemed like an odd thematic choice for this episode.
It's a dark way to open a series, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you would have to open with Jennifer's death, but there's nothing to say it had to be during that particular battle. And in a way, I think it would have perhaps made more thematic sense to just say Sisko had fought in one of the Cardassian sort of border conflicts or something. Because then at least you're linking to an antagonist of the series, you know.
To my mind, though, I think it's more about him and Picard, isn't it?
Well, that's the other thing I have issue with, is that I don't love that you're basically starting the series with these two captains completely at loggerheads. And I think it's a really poor decision, because it's never even particularly resolved. Like, we know Picard's not responsible for that. And Sisko just comes off as a bit of a jerk when he's like, oh, we met in battle, and he's clearly like upset Picard.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
He's still processing this trauma, and Sisko's a real jerk about it. And then at the end of the episode, when he's went through his own epiphany, he just is like, oh, I've changed my mind. I'm staying here at the station, and I guess we're all good now. I'm like, well, nothing's changed. You haven't actually addressed this to this man. You know what I mean? So
it is a shame. It would have been nice to have it followed up in some way. Have some other later point where Picard and Sisko, or the crews of DS9 and the Enterprise, had to work together, and we could kind of see that Sisko had moved past it. I don't think that really is sold in that last scene between them. I kind of like that we're setting up, this is, it sets it aside from next gen stuff. And I think that's kind of, to me, that was kind of important because the first two series of DS9, a lot of the stuff was very TNG feeling because, you know, obviously they were sharing the same production crews and things like that. So, and it took a little while for DS9 to really set its tone apart. But the fact that I think very early on, there was animosity between the two captains, to me at least, sort of gave me that cementing thing that we weren't going down the TNG route, but just on a space station. We were doing something a bit different. So
that's fair enough. I appreciate that would work for a lot of people. It doesn't for me, but I appreciate that if it does for you, then that's awesome, you know? Well,
these things sometimes hit differently for different people, don't they?
So. Completely, yeah. But it was just a little niggle anyway. But on in terms of just a quick note I made here, in terms of a geeky little Easter egg spot, did you recognise the actor who plays the Vulcan captain of the Saratoga?
Okay, yes. can we save this from one of my exciting stories at the end?
Oh, yes.
Shall I jump into
it? Well, do you know what? Jump into it. Why not? It gets people on board of the review already.
So, yes, the captain of the Saratoga is played by J.G. Hertzler, who's more famously known as Martok. Mm-hmm. Now, Martok is one of my absolute favourite characters. I adore Martok so much. He's brilliant. And a couple of years ago, Destination Star Trek, J.G. Hertzler is going to be there. He's not only going to be there, he's doing photos in full Klingon costume and makeup as Martok.
Oh, nice.
So I'm like, brilliant, booked, getting a picture with Martok. As we get closer, what me and the other guys on Ten Backward, we try and do, go in and keep a theme of our costumes. So the previous year we'd done original series. This year we can do next gen. So I've got myself my lovely Command Red next gen uniform. And I start thinking, do you know what would be really good? Put Captain Pips on this, Vulcan ears on, and I'm going to go, I'm not only going to cosplay as a Starfleet captain, I'm going to cosplay as the captain of the Saratoga. So when I get my photo with Martok, I'm going to be the Vulcan that J.G. Hertzler played.
Nice, very sly.
And I did. I had absolutely the cheapest, I constructed like masking tape Vulcan ears, chopped half my eyebrows off and added the lines in with eyeliner pencil. It's a really cheap makeup job. And actually, what's quite a nice uniform. But are they saying that? LeVar Burton complimented my ears. So,
well, there you go. Come on. That's got to be a good. That's awesome. I love the idea of that. So you basically had a picture of him in character as his other character.
So a little bit meta there. But absolutely, yes, I did recognise that captain.
So that goes without saying. Awesome. Yeah, it's something I noticed in recent years, obviously going back to watch it because Martok becomes so famous. But yeah, this is just a random thought that I had, but is it only me that finds the opening sequence very reminiscent of the start of Star Trek 2009 in terms of how it's a ship that's immediately facing an undefeatable enemy, gets destroyed, and one character dies that they can't save, but it's kind of the start of everything for another character.
There is that. You know, I've not considered that. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
That's watching it this time around, I was like, wow, it's surprising to me how much, because I was like, it's really tragic they have to leave Jennifer behind, but Sisko gets Jake away and they get the safety. And I was like, you know, this really reminds me of the fact that George Kirk has to sort of stay behind and die, but Winona and Jim Kirk get away, you know? So I was like, it's such a weird bit of symmetry that would never have been intentional, but it's cool, I guess. Cool. During the scene, this is just me being really mean, I guess, but during the scene in the holodeck with the sort of fishing simulation, I really thought the acting between the Siskos was really stilted. I don't know if this was just the first day they'd ever met or something, but there was something a bit off that's not in the rest of the episode, but
yeah, because I mean, one of the things I love about the two Siskos is that they do have such a really affectionate relationship as a father son thing. There's a closeness. Yeah, I hadn't particularly noticed that in that scene. If I'm honest, when I was watching the other day, I got totally caught up on how Jake comes out with his fishing rod. I'm like, why isn't it a holographic fishing rod?
I did see somebody complain about that on Twitter about, like, why do they sometimes decide to take things with them and sometimes they just use holographic clothes and other times they dress in them? And
that was me.
Was it?
And I just wondered, is this like a power saving thing? Do sometimes you replicate some things and keep them? Does the holiday, you know, do you have a regular fishing rod? Do you not just replicate it every time you go fishing?
I like the idea. I'm terrible. I won't be able to credit whoever it was that answered you, but I like the idea that somebody said it was somehow sentimental, like it was maybe a fishing rod that Jake had been given from Jennifer or something, so it had sentimental value.
that was Chris at Shelf Nerds on Twitter.
Oh yes, he's coming on the show later on in the series. Oh, so fantastic.
He's got some good ideas.
Yeah, I like that idea. I mean, it's just random headcanon, but I was like, yeah, I can dig that. If he's got a specific fishing rod he wants to use, go for it.
It's a really weird takeaway I end up going about it, but yeah.
No, it's things like that do, though. You're watching it, then you're like, hang on, how does this work? It doesn't make a lot of sense, does it?
But, yeah. Well, I mean, my thing was, if I ever end up being transported into the Star Trek universe at some point, you know, and God willing, I will be, I don't want to make a really bad faux pas by not replicating something or replicating the wrong thing. Yeah.
Anyhow, but getting back to DS9, I think I've got to shout out and give credit to the director, David Carson, who does a fantastic job and so good of a job that apparently that's how he got the gig directing Star Trek Generations, which I didn't know until I was looking it up. But I think in terms of sort of, I'll probably shout out a few of his shots that I really liked, but I just love the hero shot of DS9 through the, I think it's a runabout they're in, the window of whichever ship they're in. And you gradually sort of slowly pan around and you can't see it until they move out of shot and then the camera zooms in and it goes straight into the credits. I think that's a fantastic shot.
That's when Jake and Ben come off the holodeck, don't they? They look out of the window.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I love that. Speaking of the credits, I love the touch that I've never noticed before, that there's no wormhole in the credits because they haven't actually discovered it yet.
Yeah, that, I think it must have been like series 3 before I rewatched the pilot and realised that, I think.
So, anyhow, we get into the episode properly after the credits, and I like that there's a little bit of familiarity because the Enterprise D is docked there and you sort of, it's Chief O'Brien you're introduced to first. I think it's an interesting choice that they've got the station completely wrecked to bits. which I read about, and it was apparently done because they wanted some kind of focus to the first half, because even Michael Piller didn't really like the first half. He thought it was all too clean and there wasn't any conflict or sort of something to aim towards. So he basically said, well, just blow the crap out of the station and then we can be having the commander working on that and fixing it up and stuff as we go in. So, very interesting way to look at it. So
it makes kind of sense because it feels like the sort of thing the Cardassians would do.
Oh, completely. And it's a fantastic moment in Call to Arms when they do exactly the same thing back, which I just love. Yeah. Oh, man. Sisko programs something or other, and then Kira just says, yeah, the Cardassians want the station back. They can have it. Just blowing up left and right. I don't particularly love the religious focus of the Bajorans, but that's because I've always been on they're just wormhole aliens train, and I'm never one for loving the way sort of religion gets depicted at times in Trek. So the spiritual side I don't love, but yeah.
Because I was having this conversation the other day about how I think the original focus was that there was going to be a lot more stuff on Bajor, and a lot of the standard Star Trek exploration would be to really do the most in-depth exploration of a single planet and get around Bajor. Mm-hmm. But they kind of, the studio didn't seem to like the Bajoran storyline or the religion storyline. Mm. And so they kind of dialed that back. But then I think as the series progressed, particularly Ira Stephen Bear, who seems to have this sort of stubborn streak that he will rail against studio directives, and bless him for it because it makes marvelous. They did bring it back in. They did make it, and they made it such an integral part, and it really worked. But yeah, it was certainly a weird start to begin with.
Yeah, it's just the fact that there's something to explore there in the fact that they want the Bajorans to join the Federation, but I almost feel like a culture that's that heavily religious, that would present an issue with that, and it's not addressed yet in the pilot. I think it does get to be later, that's perhaps one of the barriers in your way, but I just feel like when Picard's mentioning to Sisko it's your goal to make them ready to be in the Federation, part of that would probably be, and we're going to have to at least, you know, do something about or come to terms with the fact that they are heavily religious people, you know?
Well, I mean, you can accept that they are religious and you can respect the that aspect of their culture. What you probably shouldn't do is set yourself up as a serious, you know, as a significant figurehead of their religion.
Yeah, well, I mean, he didn't do it, though, in perfect fairness. It was kind of thrust upon him, really. But, yeah, again, that's something that's not addressed immediately when really you would think, yeah.
It's
sort of a prime directive violation there, isn't it? Really?
Because it's one of those things that it took me several rewatches before I really got my head around the fact of what had happened. Mm. Yes, the Bajorans were spiritual people, and they had this key leader. And if a Parker backed the Federation and called for unity, it would help Bajor and set them on the path. Brilliant. Sisko goes to talk to. They talk about the orbs. He discovers the temple or the wormhole. Skipping ahead slightly, but it didn't really strike me that what he'd done until much later. It's like, oh, hang on, no, I've been thinking of them as wormhole aliens, like they all say, but yeah, actually, I've kind of just completely been oblivious to the fact that Bajorans think they're the gods.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, that is such a sort of, it's tied to destiny and whatever else, which again, I'm not really particularly on board with. I very much, you know, they're just aliens that live differently, and that's the part of this episode that I like that we'll get to when explaining about what they are in a way that it's just a different form of life. Just moving on from that then into slightly less deep territory. So I love that we're introduced to every character in sort of the most sort of best way to sum them up, I guess, in one scene. So O'Brien's sort of fixing things, which we know him anyway, but still. Mm-hmm. Sisko's wanting to solve problems and kind of get on with everyone, but he's ignoring Picard, tellingly enough. And we're introduced to Kira just basically having an argument, which I was like, this is perfect, because what other introduction for Kira could you possibly have?
So you've got you've got O'Brien the fixer, Sisko the builder, and Kira the shouter. So...
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, again, it's such clever dialogue, but the idea that O'Brien mentions in passing she's been using the office, and she's in such a bad mood after the argument that Sisko walks in, introduces himself, and her first words are just, well, I suppose you'll be wanting the office then. And his response is like, I thought I'd say hello first, then take the office. That's sort of very, I'm trying to defuse the situation here, but don't push me, you know?
Yeah,
I love it. But speaking of which, we're introduced to Odo's ability to kind of shapeshift and transform. Not the best looking of effects at this point in 1993, but it's very intriguing when you first see it. And
it blew my mind at the time. I was like, whoa, what the heck? That's awesome.
So, absolutely,
it's like any effect from back then, doesn't always hold up, particularly when you put it on the sort of screens we watch on today. But
no, I guess that's it. But maybe one day we'll get that HD remaster and it'll look great.
Hopefully.
Talking of characters, the journeys though, and how big of a journey they go on from the pilot to the end of the show, it's pretty incredible that we're introduced to Nog committing a crime. And when you think where that character ends up, it's so weird and yet cool that we're introduced to him. He doesn't even speak. He's a criminal. He's used as like leverage, and then by the end of the series, he's like a Starfleet ensign. So weird and cool.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Nog's story is incredible, but I think that's also one of the testaments to the thing we were talking about with the Federation and how DS9 portrays it as a struggle to maintain. But also, you know, it is something that is inspiring, and I think having Nog see the Federation, see the life that Federation offers. And think. Actually, I want some of that. Again, it is, and you know, the change from him and there to where he is years later is one of those great things about it.
It is. I love it. The one thing I don't love about all of this, sort of in these particular scenes, though, and feel free to disagree, is like Sisko basically using Nog as leverage and to kind of blackmail Quark into staying around, because it just doesn't strike me as very Starfleety. And I know that it's played for laughs, and it's the sort of thing that was, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out, it was the sort of thing that was done in like TOS every other week. They would do things like this, you know.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
As a clever like workaround. And I'm sure Cisco wouldn't have followed through and been like, if you're leaving, he's going to jail for years and years. But there's a little bit of, I guess, cynicism in these scenes where everything seems to be like conflict. They're all kind of at odds with each other. And the fact that that leads straight into the Cisco and Picard scene, so that there's not even like a respite in between. And I'm like, oof, this is all very un-Star Trek-y up to now in this first part, you know?
Yeah, I suppose I always saw it as this is a very different situation. And Cisco's very quickly thinking, I can't handle this like normal. But also, I suppose he's approaching it in a Ferengi way. So
yeah, that's a good way of putting it, actually. Yeah, good point.
It's, you know, it's like, what's the rule of acquisition? Something like treat people in your debt like family, exploit them.
Absolutely, I love that. Yeah, I love you've got them memorized, and that's a fantastic.
Well, I can tell you the number. I'm not quite that good, but
but yeah, that's a very good point. And again, I can, seeing it from that perspective, I can definitely appreciate it a lot more. But yeah, it's just the whole sort of thing. I think the first part for me just skews a little bit too pessimistic, because it's at this time that we start hearing about how the Cardassians have left almost nothing and the Bajoran government's about to fall and everything looks really bleak. So I was like, oof, this is just, it's a lot of, oh, what are we doing here? It's all misery and doom and gloom, which I get is the point that you have to sort of build up these stakes before then at the end you come out of that sort of dark tunnel, I guess.
Yeah.
No wormhole pun intended.
Well, yeah.
Shout out to whoever it was that made the, I'm assuming it's CGI or whatever, the appearance of Bajor on the surface looks absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
Despite being told that the planet was, you know, left in ruins by the Cardassians and facing imminent, you know, catastrophe or whatever, when you first see Sisko going to Opaka and see Bajor, I was like, wow, I'm good we didn't spend across the 7 years more times on this planet, because it's really cool and very well designed. The architecture, the look of it, it's such a... Even the cool, like, holographic pond thing that just disappears and it becomes a stairwell. It's a tiny touch, but it's so cool.
That was really cool, actually. I'd love to have seen more of that. And I think that was, like I was saying before, I think there was the intent to have a bit more going on Bajor. But, yeah, every time we do go there, we normally get one of those really gorgeous matte paintings or backdrops that just look stunning. And you're just like, that's a planet I could go and just have a really nice, relaxing couple of weeks exploring, looking at the Completely. Arts and the architecture and stuff.
That's definitely a place you'd contemplate building a cabin to move to and retire to one day.
Absolutely.
You mentioned that's basically Cisco's meeting with Opaka. So that's when we get the backstory of the Tears of the Prophets, or the Orbs, that nobody really knows what they are, but they've been around for thousands and thousands of years. And the Cardassians have all of them except this one, which is never named, but I think is the Orb of Prophecy and Change. I could be wrong. It's not named in the episode. But yeah, so Sisko gets into the middle of a sort of orb vision from the prophets or the wormhole aliens. And it's his first meeting with Jennifer, which is a very nice way for me of doing exposition and flashback. Just a little bit different. One weird moment I didn't like was Avery Brooks's acting choice. When he's like, he's just coming to the realization of what's happening, and he's got in between two worlds, and then out of nowhere, he's like, and this is the moment I met Jennifer. Ow! Yeah! I was like, what was that? He just randomly became Michael Jackson for a second. What's going on with
it? Yeah, I was always glad they didn't make that a regular thing that he would do.
It was so weird and jarring, but funny at the same time, but And this is perhaps overly critical, but I found Felicia Bell playing Jennifer very stilted in these scenes as well. But again, I guess the argument there would be it's not really her. It's like a false vision, because it's not exactly a flashback because things are changing. So,
Yeah, I mean, that's quite an interesting one, really, because I get down the rabbit hole of the minutiae there. It's like, okay, so is this playing out from Sisko's head? Is the orb extrapolating from Sisko's memory and knowledge of Jennifer, or is it pulling alternate timelines? If, you know, if time is not linear for the prophets.
Yeah, yeah. See, I assumed it was something similar to what the prophets do when he gets into the wormhole, and it was just like showing him, I guess, them role playing that, I suppose. But yeah, it's very weird. But yeah, again, it's a cooler way of showing like his attachment to his wife and how they met and stuff, as opposed to just him staring out of a window and then we do the ripple effect and it's a flashback. So
yeah. And it's a nice way to, yeah, we start off with a very tragic flashback, and his relationship with his wife then in the viewer's eyes is defined by that. So yeah, having this flashback gives us a little bit more, makes it more of a solid and real relationship to us that he had. And we can appreciate his position, I think, a bit more.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the other thing I just wanted to mention is that it's really intriguing that we end it with, related to kind of the Quark of it and everything, to the first sort of references of commerce and how it might work in Star Trek, with the idea that he wants this promenade, you know, community leader in Quark, and he wants it to be shops and people that are plying a trade and stuff, and it's not something we've ever dealt with, which isn't fundamentally a negative thing. I just think it's really interesting, and they do explore it a lot as we go on. It's an interesting thing that they chuck straight at you in the pilot. It's like, you know, we're on a space station instead of a spaceship, and we've basically got a big mall down in the basement. You know?
It's a crazy one. And again, it was one of those things I was like, hang on, it took me a while to realize. And then, so, okay, so I've got to appreciate here, this isn't a Starfleet station. We're administering it. And Bajor is now a very resource poor planet after the bottom. So it is kind of, we have to have an economy here. We have to have something to build Bajor's wealth up, because we can't shift to that Starfleet economy in the state Bajor's kind of left in, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think there's a lot of that anyway. I think the hint is that Starbases would generally be a place where they do trade and things anyway, and commerce of a sort, but obviously within Starfleet it would probably be commerce in the sense that you just picked something up and said, I'm having this, and left with it, you know, or you swapped it for something that was needed rather than using money or latinum or whatever.
Rolling back to the TNG pilot, there's that point on when they're having a look around Farpoint Station where Dr. Crusher wants to buy this sort of big load of cloth.
Yeah.
She just says to charge it to the Enterprise.
So yeah. Suggesting how does that work?
Starfleet ships go around with some sort of variation of currency they can use for local trade and barter, and just let the crew buy what they want.
It's a good point. Yeah, absolutely. And that is one of those things where I get the point of we have no currency in the future, but that was always something that I was like, I don't buy this for a second. there's no way that can be true, and it isn't, basically. So, you know.
Yeah, it's one of those things they never really get into the nitty-gritty of how it works, because, you know, to do that, you essentially have to come up with a new theory of commerce and economy that would basically wipe out capitalism.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So. Yeah, I mean, it's just enough to, I think, understand it that, you know, Starfleet doesn't, within themselves, Starfleet and the Federation doesn't use currency, but if they have to, with outsiders and stuff, they can, because there's a reason, you know, the DS9 various crew members and stuff have to have money to pay for their bar tab at Quark's or whatever, so it's got to be coming from somewhere. So, speaking of Encounter at Farpoint, then, we get introduced finally here to Bashir and Dax. Which I read was, I think it was Michael Piller's idea, because he liked that in Encounter at Farpoint, we didn't get introduced to Riker, Geordi, and Crusher, and the Crushers, I should say, until halfway through. And he kind of liked that. So it was a gradual staggering of introductions, which is, it's really cool. And I do love that, again, straight away, you're introduced to these characters as they're going to be. Bashir putting his foot straight in his mouth, flirting with Dax awkwardly, and... Yeah, and again, just the exposition behind the trail is so well done, with Sisko having known Curzon was such a genius idea of the writers.
Yeah.
So you're just straight into it, you know.
Rewatching, I was like, oh, I'd forgotten classic Bashir was so...
Oh, he's such an idiot. But again, though, there's tension between him and Kira, but she comes around to the point that, you know, he says he wants to be a hero and it's on the frontier and everything. And at the very end, in the midst of battle, she's like, time to be a hero then, Doctor. I was like, yeah, no, I can get on board with this.
And also in the way we were talking about Brad Boimler, he's almost like that little audience figure. He's like, if I was assigned to any Starbase thing, I would be excited. I would be naive and idiotic, probably like that.
Yeah.
I'd probably blunder and put my foot in it by saying something stupid like that.
Exactly. So, yeah. Again, this is just a really geeky note, but I don't love, although it's not a huge deal, that there's no explanation for why these trail are completely different from the ones in Next Gen, who we've already met, like physically in terms of the makeup, but also the fact that they're using transporters with no problem and stuff is a little bit like...
weirdly, I saw this, I saw Deus Nine before I'd seen the Trill episode of Next Gen.
Okay. Fair enough.
It did not bother me then. I think when later I realised, I was like, oh, to be fair, we're still waiting for an explanation about the Klingon forehead, so I'm not going to hold my breath on this.
Well, we got it and then had that completely removed by Discovery, so that's a whole other can of worms, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm fine with it. It's a shame to have to write off that Next Gen episode. It would be nice if they did something like what they did with the Romulans and Picard and said that, you know, the northern people have the weird bumpy foreheads and the southern ones have spots or whatever. But again, it's a minor nitpick. But
I don't get too bothered about these things. I kind of think it would sound weird for Starfleet officers to constantly parrot back these explanations in universe.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, I know that. There's a way to do it, and as I said, I think that's why I like the exposition behind what Dax is, because it comes from Sisko having known old man Curzon, and later they use the orb vision on Dax as well to show her actual joining. So it's not done with just like, oh, I'm a Trill, this is what we are, we have a worm in our... It's very subtle and quite well played. Speaking of which, the next scene was one I noted because I have absolutely no memory of this happening. In any of the previous times I've watched Emissary, but it's the scene with O'Brien saying goodbye to the Enterprise, basically. And he tries to sort of make off without seeing Picard, and Picard stops him and has a really touching moment in the transporter room. And then you even get the Next Gen theme fading into the DS9 theme, which is a really awesome, like, musical leitmotif as well. But I had no recollection of this scene, and it's brilliant. Oh. It's so emotionally impactful as well.
It's quite lovely. I like the way that O'Brien feels just a little bit awkward. It's like, I don't really think it's for me to go to the captain's ready room. I better just go. And then
Counter to that, though, the way that Picard says, you know, this was your favourite room, that I called you down here the other day asking for you just absentmindedly, and we're all going to miss you. It sort of shows that despite how awkward he might be, he really was an important part of their lives, you know? To say that as he kind of departs is like, oh, it's very bittersweet, but I like it. At least it's addressed.
And it's nice to have that kind of handover, because all those years of Next Gen and everything, and we all, obviously when the TOS movies were going while TNG was on the air, and everyone was always like, at some point, you know, the original characters have to hand the torch over. There was always a lot of talk about there being a passing of the torch. I quite liked that. It's not really the torch per se, because these are separate series they're going to go, but we had that kind of handover, the handover of Chief O'Brien, at least.
Because it's what you really, you were denied that, I guess, between Picard and Sisko, but I think I like that there's at least that there in that scene, so that's cool. Mark Alemo as Gul Dukat just hits the ground running. He's fantastic from moment one. He's immediately threatening, but that sort of smarmy charm and everything as well. Every scene with him in.
I mean, he'd done brilliantly over when we first met the Cardassians in The Wounded.
Yes.
So, you know, it was a good choice because, you know, he'd already proved himself as a really uncomfortable, creepy Cardassian before. And he just
such a, for me, just for all the criticism I've been giving the acting, I think that scene, that first scene in the office with him and Avery Brooks, is just such a really well acted scene. Like, you can sense the tension underneath the attempts to be friendly and like, your men can stay and we use our hospitality, and, you know, Dukat, I used to always love this office. Well, feel free to pop in any time, you know. It's
kind of... bit, we'll try to keep the dog off your lawn. And it's great because it kind of sets the tone that Sisko has, I think, with Dukat forever, and also I think to an extent with Weyoun. There's always this polite kind of surface of the conversation, but underneath you can tell what's going on, and it's completely under there. And I love it. It's sort of straight from the get-go. It's like he's in there going, oh, we just want to be your friends, and Sisko's all like, well, you know, we'll see what we can do. But underneath, you can tell he's going, like, I've got no time for your bullshit.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. But I appreciate that it's hard to convey, like, what's under that. If it was two lesser actors, it would be an inferior scene, but it's just, I really like, not just that scene, I think carrying on into the scenes with both Dukat and the other Cardassian, whose name I forget, who's kind of anxiously threatening them on the view screen later as well. So a lot of cool sort of tension.
I
love the fact that they basically use sort of Starfleety type science to deduce the situation, that something's in the Denorius belt and the history of it, and it's completely undetected by the Cardassians because they're just looking for a quick fix, I guess.
They sort of seem to suggest.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Cardassian approach is, let's try and break it open and see what's inside.
Yeah, although you do actually have Odo sneaking in full-on T-1000 style as the Cardassian's bag of winnings to disable their sensors or whatever as well. So,
oh, I love that scene. Cool scene.
Yeah.
That's a really nice scene because when Kira and O'Brien go in and, like, break up the party and, like, Quark's, like, furious at them, but then you sort of realise, oh, man, this is all planned. This is
planned, yeah. It's brilliant, isn't it? Yeah, such clever sort of sly little, almost a heist movie-esque way of doing things, but...
Yeah, it's like when he comes out the back, he morphs from the bag into Odo, and you're just like, brilliant. And it's almost like that bit in Star Trek 2 when Kirk's being back from the Genesis cave.
Yeah.
What Spock have done, you're just like, oh, things looked bad, but you guys were on top of this the whole time.
Yeah, and I love talking about that they have to beam him back and O'Brien struggling with the transporter. And I just love that it works because he kicks it. He just gives it a swift kick. I was like, that's not very Star Trek, but I bloody love it because that's exactly what I would do.
it's marvelous. Yeah, and it's one of those good bits as well that really sets it apart. This is not the clean, perfect technology that we're used to. This is a station that we've had to half rebuild in the last 20 minutes already.
Yeah, speaking of the technology we're used to looking sort of fabulous and everything, how gorgeous are the runabouts? Whoever designed those are just, the shot of it taking off, I actually literally paused and took a screenshot because I was like, this is stunning. Credit where it's due to the people that do these kind of model or CGI type effects and stuff, because it's just amazing. On a similar note, I think the inside and the exterior of the wormhole are an incredibly well-done effect for something that could have been very hard to convey because it's such an abstract concept.
I really enjoy the opening of the runabout bay.
Yes, yeah, on the docking bay of the station, the ring.
And it comes up and you get the full reveal on the pad. And
yes.
Like, oh, that's gorgeous. But yes, I think we've seen a wormhole in The Price in Series 3 Next Gen?
Yeah, but it was unstable, so it didn't look the same because it was constantly batting about. Yeah,
so I'm quite glad they just went full out and said, "Right, let's make something awesome." And it's absolutely like, whoa.
Yeah. I just love, again, getting into the bulk of it, which is the Sisko in the wormhole. This for me is where the episode absolutely comes alive, because it's Star Trek as espoused by Brooks as Sisko throughout. And the whole idea of a form of life that is so bizarre, they don't even have such concepts as linear time and stuff.
It's such a great concept when he's trying to have this conversation and they're all like, before, what's that? And it's like...
Yeah, but I love that it's used to, I'll probably get into it a bit more, but I love that it's used to basically, for the very human reason of basically getting him past his trauma as an almost side effect of this first contact with this weird alien species.
That's one of the beautiful bits of it is like you introduce this concept and you're just like, how on earth does that even work? You know, that's like, that is a mind bender.
Yeah.
To have to just exist in all moments at the same time, to have no past or future or present.
Yeah.
And then to turn around and say, but because of his grief, he doesn't exist in a linear fashion. He exists in this one point because he can't bring himself past the death of his wife. Like, flip, yeah.
Yeah, I know. I completely, that's exactly, more or less exactly what I would have said. Like I said, just, I think the dialogue here, there's so many things that I had to note that are important, which is that my species respects life above all else. We are the sum of our experiences. We live in one point in time. And the fact that I know it, it's all about the nature of loss, which is really deep and profound and quite human, like all the best Trek stories. And how Sisko says there are days that shape your future that will become important, and those can be good or bad. And I think Brooks acts his backside off in these scenes, so that he's living through his experience while still being the sort of quintessential Starfleet captain educating these aliens, and just the absolute gut punch of them saying, well then, so why do you exist here? And it's Jennifer's death. It's like, oh, not good. So the fact that he also says, we're aware that every choice we make has a consequence, so we use our past experiences. Think of it like competition, and it gets into, of course, the baseball type thing. So it's like, when you throw the ball, there are a number of possibilities. And I was like, yeah, if this is giving you the fact that he loves baseball, I get it.
But that's so, and if you, when you've watched the series and you go back and you're just like, yeah, that's so Sisko. It's like, okay, I've got a completely alien kind of life. Their entire existence is a different sort of thing to us. Baseball, let's try baseball to kind of find that common ground. And it doesn't work. And in the end, he's just like, well, the important thing is it's you don't know what's going to happen.
The rules aren't important. Exactly, yeah. But I love that, again, the way they fist things back at him is so cleverly done by, it would have been really hard for a writer to have to put them into the mind space of someone that doesn't grasp. So like, you value your ignorance of what is to come. And Sisko's, it is the unknown that defines our existence, is, again, Star Trek summed up in a line, really, isn't it?
Did you ever get any of the VHS tapes back in when DS9 was coming out and they were being released?
I did, yeah.
Because they was certainly in the early series, they always used to put a key quote on the cover sleeve.
They did, yeah, on the, it was the back of it as well, before you got in. Yeah, I did. I was, unfortunately, I was collecting the DS9 and Voyagers when there was like two episodes on a VHS for about £15.
I think the Emissary video had that particular quote as you said it, and I was like,
okay, cool.
Quotes on the covers. I remember the Emissary one. I think I remember the one that was that had Defiant on it, and it was "You shouldn't go fishing today." Those two particularly stick in my mind.
Fair enough. I can't remember any of them, but I'm going to probably end up looking that up now. But so just to finish off the whole sort of Sisko with the prophets, they point out that it's him that's bringing them to Jennifer's death, and he denies himself moving on. And again, it's incredibly deep on a level I never got before now, that he basically says, because I was ready to die with her. So I never left this ship. I've not allowed myself to move on because I've never figured out how to live without her. And it's not linear, which again, it's beautifully phrased and put for just basically, I can't get over the death of my wife. The fact that they help him out is brilliant. And I'll just quickly go through the other thing, which was the, I love the sort of face off with the Cardassians and the station trying to move to the wormhole to be claimed. The fact that it's so tense and every little moment from kind of, fire the 6 torpedoes. We only have 6 torpedoes. We're not going to win this battle with torpedoes, Chief.
It's just, Kira is so badass there. She's brilliant. Great. Yeah, she just comes across like a seasoned Trek captain, and really, you know, she's ready to bluff. She's got no fear. She's facing this Gul'jazar down. She's brilliant. She's also making unreasonable demands of her engineer, like a Starfleet captain would.
Again, though, it's great that you then get O'Brien saying, bloody Cardassians, I just got the tap, which I just love. And it's a subtle moment again, but Odo getting his moment of kind of humanity because Bashir makes him help sort of treating a wounded crewman. It's a subtle moment, but I think it's important for his development later on. So
I noted René Auberjonois plays that so well because he's so awkward.
Yes.
He plays that beautifully awkward, like, I don't know what.
Yeah, perhaps I should get someone else. No, no, just help. It's lovely.
Yeah. And the fact you've got a full head makeup mask on you, the emotion he conveys through that is incredible. Shout out to the acting and Ronnie O'Brien from the very beginning was amazing. Absolutely. In that role.
Yeah. I think, so, yeah, everyone's really, really good in the acting and everything, but... So the next section, just quickly, which is the, as you probably know, the Jean's vision section, which is how does this episode fit into that sort of mighty ideology of Star Trek, which, again, on first view, you might think it sort of flies in the face of that a little bit at first, but I think there's enough there. So is there anything that you picked up on, especially besides the obvious?
I think everything we were saying about Sisko and the wormhole aliens. Yep. It's the unknown that defines our existence. That totally goes in with a famous quote of Roddenberry's. And if I'd been a bit more, had a bit more about me, I would have looked it up for definite. But it's essentially like it was saying that the day that we stop being concerned about our differences and reveling in our differences, I think, and that something along those lines about enjoying and being excited to find other people and being, you know, the differences between their lives and outlooks and yours, and being able to celebrate those differences. And that's what this does. You know, Sisko goes there and says, we look for the unknown. We want to find the unknown and find it, you know, and we want to engage with you people who are so different because those differences don't matter, kind of. So I think absolutely the way Sisko approaches the aliens and forms that relationship with them is very much in Gene's vision.
Absolutely. I completely agree. I'll get to that because I've just basically written down the quote because I think it's perfect, but it's quite long. Where to start? We've touched on a lot of this, so you can just go back and listen. But the idea of sort of Jadzia as a Trill, sort of a complex identity and diversity is included there as well. The idea of kind of the science officers are studying things rather than like the Cardassians just waiting for things to happen. I like, again, the O'Brien goodbye moment with the Enterprise and Picard is very sort of, it's Trek in the emotional spectrum, I guess. Bashir wanting to be a hero, Odo's little moment helping him. The bluff and the grit, I guess, of Kira, despite not being a Starfleet officer, is very reminiscent of certainly the earlier Treks. And it's very sort of Trek-esque for me that I think Sisko's whole arc in this is a giant metaphor for the depression of like not getting past his grief. He is basically talked through that by the counselors of the wormhole aliens. So it's cool. But yeah, the key thing is, as I said, and I've just written this whole quote, between Sisko and the prophets, this is where it's summed up for me. And it's, you value your ignorance of what's to come. That may be the most important thing to understand about humans. It's the unknown that defines our existence. We are constantly searching, not just for answers to our questions, but for new questions. We are explorers. We live our lives day by day and we explore the galaxy, trying to explore the boundaries of our knowledge. And that is why I'm here, not to conquer you with weapons or with ideas, but to coexist and learn. Perfect.
Yeah.
Just one speech that you could just sum everything up perfectly. So 100% to Michael Piller, who I think wrote that speech. Fantastic work. Just a summation of everything beautifully.
So, absolutely.
So what I'll do now then, if you have a conclusion and then a score out of 5 Starfleet Deltas, I will get yours and then give my own.
I think I covered all my main points. It's a great start to it. So, I don't find a great deal wrong. I'm kind of known for being very difficult to ever find any fault with any Star Trek. So I'm going to just go in at full 5 out of 5 for me.
No problem. 5 out of 5. Okay. So my conclusion is that I said it's a slow and shaky start and it seems to want to fly in the face of Trek ideology and distance itself. However, it also features the most ambitious, profound, and a lot of intriguing plots, both within this 90 minutes and set up to come later. A bleak first half gives way to a traditional Trek staple, using sci-fi to explore deep themes of life, loss, and linear existence in very profound and affecting ways. Some characters are better established than others. For example, Bashir is quite superfluous, and there's a very mixed bag of acting, but with at least 2 or 3 truly moving and outstanding performances. The writing is complex, intense, intelligent, and very resonant for the most part. The direction is handled perfectly, and the effects are as beautiful to this nerd as ever. A complicated, exploratory, sometimes challenging, but incredibly intriguing start to a series that would be defined by being all of these things. And I gave it 4 Starfleet Deltas out of 5. So the average would therefore for the podcast be 4.5 out of 5, which places Emissary in second place in our leaderboard so far, just behind the Lower Decks episode, No Small Parts. So so there we go. Very well regarded and received episode. So before I jump us into the next section, then, did you have any other sort of stories or tidbits about Emissary that you wanted to share?
Okay, so I think when I first saw Emissary, I discovered a local fan group by accident, which was fantastic. So they met every month, and they had a little hall. The guy organising it got 2 TVs set up, rigged up to 1 video, and this is, what, 93, 94, so I was about 14. And he had a friend in America who used to basically record off the TV and mail the tapes over. So there was no chance of watching Emissary or any of DS9 for ages, unless I had Sky, which I didn't. So this was a fantastic bonus for me, and I was absolutely in love with it from the start. But this was also during that point where TNG had come off BBC after Best of Both Worlds. And so we're at season 6 of TNG, and I've got no idea what's happened after Best of Both Worlds. So for me, it was almost like Best of Both Worlds happened, and then DS9 starts with the Battle of Worlds 359. I was like, brilliant, I know what's going on here. I didn't know anything about the Trill. I don't think I even knew Brandon got married. So I regard Emissary both highly in that I think it's an excellent, but also it was kind of a new chapter in that I discovered a group of fans, whereas before I'd been sort of, it was me and 2 or 3 friends, school friends who watched Star Trek and talked about it. So it was like, almost like, it was my first step into having a wider fandom group, which then obviously grew later when I started doing conventions and Twitter and Star Trek Twitter community. So yeah, I got very fond memories of it from that because it was like a brand new chapter in being a Star Trek fan for me. So.
Oh, that's fantastic to hear. I do like to hear people finding the sort of similar fans and stuff to interact with. I will finish us off then with the final section of this episode, which is what I call subspace communication or audience interaction section. I posted a tweet literally an hour before we started recording because I had forgotten, asking for people's opinions on Emissary. And bizarrely enough, I have actually had quite a few replies to it. So slap on the wrist for me for forgetting to actually post it earlier in the week. But thank you to everyone who I will shout out now who's replied. And I'll just quickly go through it. The first one here is at Where's the Oberth, who says, Emissary is my favorite Star Trek pilot, hands down. Also one of my favorite episodes. An interesting concept, executed fantastically. With TOS and TNG, it always took me some time to warm to the new captain. This gave me that connection with Sisko pretty much instantly. Okay. At Enigma Nort says, I love Emissary. It's a sharp story with a smart premise and a powerful emotional arc for Sisko. I've watched it over and over. Great. At James Brummel says, in my opinion, it's the best Star Trek first episode out there. It's the only one that delves deep into a character's development and says something about human nature. Yeah, couldn't agree with that, that more. So at Eclipse 1982 says, it was great. It provided so much background for Ben Sisko and made me like him so much. He was a troubled human rather than the other captains, with tragic events shaping who he is and what he later became. Just a couple more. At Rogue Moog says, it was slow on my first watch, but is so much better knowing the ending of the series. It's incredibly profound and so very Star Trek. Sisko trying to explain linear time to aliens is about as high concept as it gets. And finally, at Dog Food for Chair says, I liked it a lot. It drew me in. People say the early seasons are slow, but without their world building and characterization, the impact episodes in later seasons wouldn't resonate as much. So yeah, I think pretty much a lot of universal praise for the episode, not a lot of criticism. The odd niggles here and there. So excellent. That will wrap up our deep dive into Emissary, and just remains for me to say thank you so much for joining me. Apologies for keeping you for so long, Rick. It's been fantastic.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, awesome. I've really enjoyed it again because I could just spend hours and hours speaking with like-minded Trek fans when we get going. Did you want to shout out any of your sort of socials or anything to
Yeah, I mean, I'm always up for talking any Star Trek on Twitter, so I'm at TrekFanRick. And I should probably do a cheeky plug for my own podcast at Absolutely. 10 Backwards.
Yeah.
which is just a discussion podcast. We talk about various Star Trek themes and ideas fairly randomly, normally with a little bit of silliness involved. So, yeah.
And very good it is too. Yeah, in the meantime, thanks again, Rick, and everyone else. Remember, we are Starfleet. Live long and prosper.
Live long and prosper.
You have been listening to the Hit or Miss Star Trek podcast, part of the Hit or Miss Who Trek channel. Hit or Miss Star Trek is hosted by Mike Wilson, scripted, produced, and edited by Mike Wilson, based on an idea by Mike Wilson and Will Templar. Follow us on YouTube, your podcatcher of choice, and our social media. Links to all of these can be found by clicking on the link tree in the episode descriptions. This podcast is a Media Matters original production. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share this podcast throughout subspace. We'll be back for another thrilling trek through the stars soon, but for now, hailing frequencies closed.
Try to warp out of here at once, maximum speed.